Good evening. On muggy days in summer, when the city is unbearably hot and sticky, it's nice to get down to the shore and take a plunge in the cool, crisp ocean. Gives one a tingly feeling all over. And on fall nights like this, when the air is filled with smoke from burning leaves, and the witches are oiling up their broomsticks in anticipation of Halloween, you can get a different kind of a spine tickle by reading a good ghost story. I have such a yarn for you tonight. A true story of a truly haunted house. Not a tumble-down shack in the midst of dead trees like the one Alexander Wolcott talked about, but a great big beautiful New Hampshire mansion, where literally hundreds of birds came to feed and sing in the lovely old-fashioned garden, and where, I am sure, the ghost of the man who built the place must lurk on dark and dismal nights when the fog creeps up from the sea and shrouds the house in mystery and gloom. Recently, Mrs. Blackington and I visited this haunted house, and the present owners, Mr. Harland Little and his two charming sisters, knowing of my interest in things historical and supernatural, graciously entertained us in Hampton House and permitted us to read original letters and manuscripts from George Washington, John Greenleaf Whittier, and others that substantiate the unbelievable tale that has been told and the tales that have been written about General Jonathan Moulton, who built the mansion where the Littles now reside. The General's robust spirit still haunts the house. Folks hear him every so often, stomping around upstairs, rattling the dishes and knocking down things in the attic. Shortly after his death in 1788, the house was sold to a well-to-do family named Gardner. They had a coach and four, several servants, and did a lot of entertaining. But they never could be sure when the ghost of Jonathan Moulton would scare the daylights out of their guests. Everybody in Hampton knew he was still hanging around the place. And finally, Mr. Gardner went down to Portsmouth and got the rector of the church to come up to lay the general's ghost. Evidently, the pastor was new at the job, for the rappings and bangings kept up, and the gardeners moved out. For a long time, the house remained deserted. Then another family moved in for a little while, but they couldn't stand it either. And then, according to Eleanor Early, who writes about General Moulton in her book, A New England Sampler, Lawyer Whipple bought Hampton House. And to put an end to the pranks of the ubiquitous phantom, Mr. Whipple fetched two ministers from Portsmouth. And they went from room to room doing whatever ministers do to exorcise a ghost. And finally, they drove him down cellar and into an apple bin. They kept him there till a hired man nailed the bin up so tight a henlouse couldn't get out of it. And there he stayed till Squire Toll bought the place a few years later and foolishly pried the lid off the apple bin. And then the fun started all over again. Mr. Sanger Atwell of Lynn, an authority on furniture and antiques, tells me that after the Toll family moved out, Hampton House remained unoccupied until an old cobbler came to live there. He preferred to tap his shoes by lamplight, but the general's ghost kept blowing out the lamp, and in disgust, the cobbler went back to candles. As fast as he fixed the boots and shoes of his customers, he'd hang them from a rafter. And time and again, he was awakened in the dead of night by those empty boots dancing a jig above his head when there was no one else in the house and not a breath of wind outside. Hampton folks will tell you that other ghosts had inhabited the Moulton house. The lively spirit of Johnny Squaretoes, a dwarf servant of the general, hung around the place. And for a time after her death, Madam Moulton, the first wife, glided through the halls and partitions, her stiff brocade skirts swishing and rustling to her stately step. What was she doing there? Probably keeping an eye on Jonathan, who hadn't waited until she was in her grave before he gave her jewels to her best girlfriend, lovely Sarah Emery, whom he married on September 11th, 1776. This Jonathan Moulton was a direct descendant of John and Anne Moulton, who, with 50 others, came in 1638 from the town of Ormsby in the county of Norfolk, England, across the Atlantic to a place called by the Indians Winnicummit, but known to us as Hampton, New Hampshire. Here in 1726, Jonathan Moulton was born, and here he grew to manhood, a strong, restless, domineering young man whose one object in life was to be the richest man in the state. What he couldn't obtain by brute force, he took slyly by subterfuge. A mighty man in his community, he reached high for place and power, and won them both, and also the hatred of his fellow townsmen, who were jealous of the wealth that unmitigated gall and prodigious strength had brought to him. No one can doubt his physical courage, for history records that Jonathan fought with distinction in the French and Indian Wars. And on August the 24th, 1775, he was made a colonel of the 3rd Regiment of the Militia, for the Provincial Congress, then in session at Exeter. As a young man of 20, he'd driven some sharp bargains. He'd been fortunate enough to be present when valuable cargoes drifted ashore from wrecks along the coast. In 1749, Jonathan Moulton had taken his place in Hampton society. He'd built a magnificent mansion. He had married Miss Abigail Smith, and he was still but 23 years of age. He gave his wife all the silks and satins she wanted, imported china and plenty of pearls and diamonds. On November the 17th, 1763, the Masonian proprietors granted a township near Lake Winnipesaukee to a group of citizens headed by young Mr. Moulton, and he insisted that the new town should be called the Borough of Moulton, or Moultonboro, and under that name it was incorporated in 1777. He should have been satisfied with that real estate deal, but he wasn't. And the same year that he got Moultonboro for practically nothing, he put over a fast one on Governor Benning Wentworth. The governor had a flair for fine cattle, and Moulton, who knew about everything, found in a farmer's barn a sturdy young bull, white as snow and as handsome as a picture. He bought the bull and fatted him. And when he tipped the scales at 1,400 pounds, Moulton gilded his hooves with gold paint, hoisted a flag from his horns, and marched him down to Portsmouth where the governor was holding forth. "Your Excellency," Jonathan said in his smoothest tone, "I have brought you a gift, the finest bull in the whole new world." The governor was flabbergasted. "But, my dear friend, I cannot accept such a gift as this without giving you something in return. There must be something I can do for you." "Well, Your Excellency, come to think of it, there is a little gore of land that I've always admired. It's not much to look at on the map, just some fields and trees and a brook or two." "Of course, my dear sir. Here, clerk, make out a deed to Mr. Jonathan Moulton for this little gore of land. Make it out now so he can take the paper with him." And thus it happened that General Moulton, smiling to himself, left Portsmouth with a piece of parchment that gave him sole right and ownership in a small gore of land. Yeah, only about 19,456 acres of the richest land in all New Hampshire. Well, time and again, Moulton boasted that he was scared of neither God, man, nor devil. And one blustery October evening, when he was toasting his shins in front of the great fireplace in Hampton House, he muttered to himself that he'd sell his soul to the devil to have unbounded riches. Suddenly, a shower of sparks came down the chimney, and out of a sulfurous puff of smoke, a sinister figure in black bowed low and said, "At your service, sir." The visitor thrust his claw-like hand into the fire, picked up a live coal in his fingers, held it close to his watch, and added, "But we must hurry. I've got to be at the governor's house in 15 minutes. From his cloak, he produced a parchment scroll with many names on it. "Sign this release for your immortal soul, Jonathan Moulton, and I'll make you the richest man in all the province." Jonathan, cold, sober, and shaking with fear, was still the Yankee trader. Yes, of course, Your Majesty, but how do I know you can do this, after all?" Well, the words had hardly left his trembling lips when the devil snapped his fingers, and a shower of gleaming gold coins fell clanking to the floor. Moulton reached for one and dropped it with a cry of pain because it was red hot. The devil picked it up, blew on it to cool it, tossed it to Jonathan. "Look it over. Bite it. Toss it upon yonder marble slab and hear it ring. It's pure gold, and I'll make you thousands like it. If it's a bargain, get pen and ink and a little brandy to bind the deal." Moulton brought a flask and two glasses, and the moment the devil touched his glass, the liquid took fire. But he drank the flaming fluid with one gulp. "Now to business, my friend. I agree on my part on the first day of every month to fill your boots with gold coins like these, as many as your boots will hold. But mark me well. If you try any tricks, you will repent it." Satan then opened the scroll, and Jonathan, dipping his quill into the inkhorn, affixed his signature to the long list of prominent names on that fatal list. "At least," he said to Satan, "I'll be in distinguished company." The devil helped himself to another drink. Then he wrapped his long black coat around him and vanished up the chimney. I photographed that chimney a few days ago and examined the fireplace carefully. It's in the oldest part of Hampton House, and it is tremendous. In the very room where Mr. Little and his sisters and Mrs. Blackington and I and Sanger Atwell sat enjoying cake and coffee, the devil kept his word with Jonathan Moulton on the first of every month. But even that didn't satisfy the greedy man. He hunted around till he found the biggest pair of boots in 50 miles, and he cut the toes out of them before he hung them on the crane in the fireplace. Come the first of March, 1769, and true to his promise, the devil dug his claws into the sloping, snow-covered roof of Hampton House and poured the gold down the chimney in an endless stream. But this time there was no sound of a boot well filled with metal. The coins just disappeared. So he made another batch and sent them spiraling down the sooty chimney, and then more and more. What trickery was this? Did Jonathan Moulton think he could outwit Satan himself? The devil swung low and peeked through a crack in the shutters. candlelight fell upon a cascade of coins that spilled out of the fireplace and over the floor. It fell upon the greedy face of Moulton hiding in the shadow. The devil went back to the chimney, and the coins he tossed down were white hot and smoking. One of them rolled through a crack into the cobwebs and dust, and soon a thin wreath of smoke and a tiny tongue of flame sprang up, crept along under the broad floorboards until, caught by the draft, it leaped between the partitions, flashed through walls, and burst with a golden glare from the windows of the attic. Jonathan, busy scooping up the coins in a bushel basket, knew nothing of the fire's progress till he heard a scream from the second floor. The whole far end of the mansion was ablaze. Several guests leaped from their rooms into the snowbank below. And if you're interested, you can read in old newspapers a detailed account of that great fire. The glare of the flames were seen in Portsmouth. The loss was £3,000. Part of the house was saved, and Moulton thought sure he'd find the melted gold in one big lump among the ruins of the deep cellar. But not a coin could be found. The fire took place in the spring of 1769. And later that same year, Moulton built a new mansion, the one I visited a few weeks ago. In this new home, General Moulton lived high, wide, and handsome, with parties that were the talk of the countryside. Here his first wife, Abigail Smith, died under questionable circumstances. Before her hands were cold in death, the doughty general had stripped them of the diamonds he'd given her. And before she was laid to rest, he had given the jewels to her companion, sweet-faced, smiling Sarah Emery, whom he married on September 11th, 1776. The celebration lasted 3 days. And on the wedding night in the southeast corner bedroom, the best blue room, where, as John Greenleaf Whittier wrote, from the oaken mantel glowing, faintest light the lamp is throwing, on the mirror's antique mold, high-backed chair and wainscot old, and through faded curtains stealing, his dark sleeping face revealing, the general slept, his head heavy from the wine of the wedding feast. Then suddenly his bride was awakened by a cold draft of air. She heard the rustle of silk and saw in the dim light the spectral figure of Madame Moulton stretching her thin hands toward her. As the icy fingers of the dead wife closed about her own and the rings were snatched from her fair hands, Sarah Moulton screamed, awakening all the household. They brought candles and lamps and searched every nook and cranny, but the rings and bracelets were never found. This incident attracted the attention of the poet Whittier, and you'll find the story in his poem, The New Wife and the Old. And so on fall nights when the moon shines behind the bare branches of the trees, or autumn rains pelt against the windows while the surf piles high along the shore down Hampton Way, folks still hear and see things that are hard to explain. Many believe old General Moulton, cursed by the devil and unable to enter the kingdom of heaven, like Count Dracula, is still searching for his grave. For in spite of his affluence and standing in the community, no one knows what happened to the mortal remains of Jonathan Moulton. Sometime after he died in 1788 at the age of 62, his coffin was opened and found to be filled with stones. Personally, I think the old boy is looking for his gold. If I had the time, I'd like to help him hunt for it. Good night.